Call this a blues for Gigi, George General Grice, Jr. You may not know his name, but it is likely you have heard his music. His is the story of an alto saxophonist who earned respect as a composer, player, and teacher of some of the most beautiful and interesting music in jazz. Some pieces like Social Call and Minority went on to become jazz standards. It is also the story of a man who, after achieving international acclaim as a performer, suddenly and permanently disappeared from the scene to work in relative obscurity for the rest of his life. The name Gigi Grice is rarely, if ever, mentioned in the same breath as the greats with whom he helped build a genre. Their names, Thelonious Monk, Clifford Brown, Art Farmer, Lionel Hampton, Quincy Jones, make up a jazz who's who. Now a new book, Rat Race Blues, looks to bring the contributions of Gigi Grice to light. Joining us is Michael Fitzgerald, co-author of the book. Michael, welcome.
Thank you.
In doing your research for Rat Race Blues, you interviewed many of people who knew and worked with Grice. What's the impression you get? What kind of guy was he?
Well, he was completely the opposite of what many people consider to be the typical jazz musician. He didn't smoke, he didn't drink, he didn't do drugs. He was a classically trained composer. He studied with Alan Hovhaness at Boston Conservatory. He was not really a street musician, and he came from this sort of a different background than many of his colleagues at the time.
He also came from the Deep South, from Pensacola, Florida.
That's right.
How does a musician from that time, I believe he was born in 1925, make it from Pensacola to Harlem?
Well, in World War II, he was in the Navy band in Illinois, and from then he made use of the GI Bill to travel north, initially to Hartford, Connecticut, where his sister had moved, and then to Boston, where he studied at the conservatory.
And then from there on to New York.
Yes, absolutely.
His New York years were some of his most creative and productive. He studied and collaborated with greats like Thelonious Monk, for example. What are some of the musical high points of his time there?
Well, by the time he arrived in New York, it was 1953, and immediately he was in the thick of things. He was working with Max Roach. He was recording with Howard McGhee for Blue Note Records. And then he met Clifford Brown, the trumpeter, in August of 1953. They recorded a Gigi Grice composition entitled Hymn to the Orient, which that particular recording has been singled out many times as being a classic.
Let's listen to a little bit of Hymn to the Orient. Gigi Grice is often called a musician's musician. And when I bring up the name Gigi Grice to musicians, they get sort of this rhapsodic look in their eyes, and they talk in particular about the bridge of him to the Orient. What is so special about that particular part of that particular song?
Well, harmonically, the piece, it's not doing what was typical of the time. It's moving with different chords in different ways. That actually foreshadow some of the later developments in jazz by people like John Coltrane.
How would they sort of grow and cultivate this music? Did they jam, practice, and play all night and then record all day? What was it like?
Gigi's career basically spanned from 1953 up until about 1961 or 62. And during that time, there were many, many clubs in New York. It was possible to work for long stretches of time, as opposed to now where it's mainly a week engagement at most. And in addition to that, there were record sessions happening every day. Musicians would travel from New York to Rudy Van Gelder's studio in New Jersey, and so many labels were recording, and they would have the studio booked up, and Gigi was on these sessions, he wrote for these sessions, people used his compositions. He also was involved in the New York studio scene, recording more commercial things, and doing writing and arranging for singers. He even ended up writing some commercial things for Pepsi-Cola.
New York is also the place where Gigi Grice started his push for musicians' rights. What did he want for them and for himself?
He was very interested in getting respect for the music. It was not so much entertainment to him as it was art. And particularly in the financial aspects, he was concerned that musicians were receiving what they were due in terms of publishing royalties. That was a big thing for him. So he started two publishing companies, Mellotone and Totem, that handled his compositions and the compositions of other colleagues of his.
Did that also make him a threat?
It made him somewhat unpopular with the establishment, and record companies, oftentimes, they held the publishing rights to the compositions that they recorded. And when you have money being taken away from them, they weren't so happy about it.
And was that instrumental in Gigi Grice deciding to drop off the scene altogether?
There was something that contributed to that. There were a number of other things that made life difficult for Gigi as a jazz musician. He had a dislike for travel. He wouldn't fly. He didn't take long car trips. Partly because his friend Clifford Brown had been killed in a car accident on the road. So he wasn't able to do as much of the things that would have made him a greater success in terms of a wider recognition.
In your research for Rat Race Blues, did you come across any indication that perhaps Gigi Grice regretted his decision to stop performing?
There were points when we're talking with his brother Tommy, who was a tenor saxophonist in New Jersey, that there were moments of regret. But he really, once he made the decision, he never looked back. He cut off contact with his jazz musician colleagues. He changed his name. He used his Muslim name, Bashir Qasim, and became a teacher. He was a devout Muslim. He really did not have any interaction with the jazz community after he left.
So, Michael, we have a world-renowned musician who suddenly makes this transition to being a school teacher. How did he make that transition? Was he missed? Did his friends know where to find him?
They really didn't. He made a complete break with the jazz scene and changed his name. And at that time, his wife left him and took his children. He didn't have contact with his family. All sorts of rumors existed in the music, in the jazz community, that he had been rubbed out by the mob, or that he had moved to Europe, or he had moved to Africa. All of these were false.
And Michael, what was the truth?
The truth was that he turned his back on his career. He became a different person. The Gigi Grice, the jazz musician, ceased to exist. During the late 1960s, even his brother didn't know where to find him when his mother died.
What is his legacy as a teacher?
Well, as a teacher, his last school where he taught was named for him. It's called the Gigi Grice, the Bashir Qasim Gigi Grice Elementary School. It's in the Bronx. He was apparently well-loved there. And as a composer, up until now, he's been a sort of a footnote in jazz history. When they look at things in terms of the great man theory, people skip over Gigi Grice. And it's really a shame, because his contributions there were so many of them, and they have lasted throughout the years, that he really deserves to be looked at in the full perspective.
We've been talking with Michael Fitzgerald, co-author of Rat Race Blues, The Musical Life of G.G. Grice. Michael, thank you for being with us today.
It's been my pleasure.